The Guardian.
Support for this podcast comes from Squarespace, the all-in-one platform that makes creating a professional website for your business, personal brand, or portfolio so easy, it's newsworthy. Go to squarespace.com and use the offer Guardian to get 10% off.
The Guardian Books Podcast with Richard Lee.
Out, and as we head for the beach, or at least the local park, our thoughts turn with the inevitability of parched lawns and lost luggage to holiday reading. With me in the studio to give us some packing tips are The Guardian's Lindsay Irvin and The Observer's Robert McCrum. But for anyone thinking of travelling with some contemporary literary fiction, the Booker jury has offered a few helpful hints with the announcement earlier this week of the 2014 Man Booker longlist. This year, a revolutionary rule change enlarges the field of entry from the Commonwealth to the entire world, with writers of any nationality eligible for the award as long as they're published in the UK and writing in English. But the judges, they seem to have been keen to defend the status of British letters, don't they, Robert, with only 4.5 Americans on the list?
Well, what's happened is that they finally put into practice the scheme which they established last year of having American writers eligible for the first time, which is something I've always supported because I think it means that you for the first time ever you now have a proper representation of the global English fictional experience. And of course they are no doubt very wary of the accusation that they're going to capitulate to the Americans and
the invasion.
I think this list feels like a list being put together by a committee, which is what they are. And there have been some losers, but they've handled it fairly well. It's not a great list, but it's a good list. And they've handled the American question quite well. And
the Americans on the list, there's Joshua Ferris, Siri Husfed, Richard Powers, Karen Joy Fowle, and then the half is the Irish-American writer Joseph O'Neill.
Yeah, he's more American than Irish, but I think he has an American blood. There's some Irish blood there in the background. You know, it's not a revolutionary selection by any means. It's not terribly innovative. It's quite safe. Of the Americans, at least, but it's good.
The American novels are a very interesting selection, but I do think we need to counterpoint hurrahs for their inclusion with the fact that the new dispensation lends itself to promoting American books that are already prominent.
I mean, they're 4.5 Americans. Yes. There's no space for Donna Tartt, no space for Jonathan Lethem, no Dave Eggers, who could have been there twice.
No, it's a good selection of fairly obvious American names. Nothing revolutionary, but there are some omissions, I think.
It's also a very male list, isn't it, Lindsay, with only three women, and there's only one writer, Neil Mukherjee, who isn't white. A.C. Grayling said that this year there was a fall in Commonwealth submissions. But does this long list show that those who were worried the new rules would push writers outside that London-New York axis to one side were right?
Well, you do have to worry about it. It's not that exclusive this year because we do have Neil Mukherjee. A very vibrant Commonwealth scene is much less exposed. And that's a vital part of the literary calendar, both here, which has enabled us to get to know writers like Rehinton Mystery.
Arundhati Roy.
Arundhati Roy, example. Yeah.
Salman Rushdie, even.
If you go back to what you might think of as the great days of Booker, those lists had loads of Indians, loads of Australians, loads of Canadians, South Africans, and they're not here.
Yeah, so this is a global list that is arguably more kind of aligned
less
along a particular...
Global. Yes,
But, I mean, I'd slightly pity the poor judges having to boil this year down to only 13 books. I mean, there's no space on the list for Ian McEwan or Sarah Waters or even Nicola Buck.
I feel sorry about Sarah Waters. I think Sarah Waters is really talented. I'm sorry about Donna Tartt too, but I think Sarah is really talented, right? And I wish she'd been on the list. Donna Tartt, I think, would feel slightly put out, if she cares. She's probably just too busy counting her money to worried about the price.
Best selling them, oh dear. But what about the books that actually made it onto the list, Lindsay? What do you make of the selection?
There is definitely interesting material there. I'm very interested, I haven't read it all yet, in Howard Jacobson's new novel, which he's won it a couple of years ago, but this novel is a real departure for him away from neurasthenic London comedies into a dystopian future, which is not what anybody would have expected from Jacobson.
There is humour on the list, but probably not from him. I mean, Joshua Ferris is
it's also worth saying that, Richard, that no funny book has ever won the Booker Prize, actually. I mean, leaving aside Howard, Jacobson.
And The Old Devils?
Well, ish funny.
Ish, okay.
But laugh out loud. But an outright funny book has never won the Booker Prize. So maybe this is the year when, if Joshua Ferris were to win, that would be a first.
Yeah. And then there's formal experimentation as well from the crowdsourced account of Guerrillas Against the Norman Conquest from Paul Kingsnorth, which I think for me is one of the most exciting books on the list.
That's one that will require a bit of concentration.
From the reader.
It's in a sort of reinvented version of Old English, isn't it?
Yes, exactly.
Not necessarily. An obvious crowd, please. but a brave inclusion.
Yeah, absolutely. But by the end of the summer, I'm sure there'll be plenty of book-along-listed novels with sand between their pages. But our readers aren't only packing contemporary fiction, are they, Lindsay?
Well, there is a lot to be said for our commenter B. McLean's resolution to get a lot of things I should have read years ago but kept putting off read. And that's starting with Flaubert's Sentimental Education and Trollope's Phineas Finn are on his slate.
We've also got a comment from ID302405, a very anonymous comment, who remembers being kind of stuck, as he or she puts it, with books that didn't work out, so has already embarked on Gravity's Rainbow.
Yes, and Jason A. Park seems to be taking his entire to-read pile, including I, Claudius and the White Goddess by Robert Graves, Black Lamb and Grey Falcon by Rebecca West, and the complete short stories of J.G. Ballard, so no time for windsurfing for you.
You're packing a bit of Turgenev this summer, aren't you?
I'm taking Fathers and Sons because I recently went to the Dunmar and saw this brilliant production, which I urge anyone to go and see if they possibly get a ticket, of Brian Friel's adaptation of Fathers and Sons, and I've never read it. And it's a short, it's virtually a novella by Turgenev, very controversial at the time, and I've never read it, and I want to answer that a bit with me on my trip to Turkey.
Anything else that's going to see a bit of sun?
And I want to take some non-fiction, because I'm currently immersed in the 100 Greatest Novels of All Time, which is, you know, one novel a week, so I've been doing that for a year, and I've got another year to go. So I'm going to take some non-fiction. I'm going to take Ben McIntyre's A Spy Among Friends, which is great fun. I've begun to read it. And also Michael Lewis's Flash Boys, a book about the American money business.
Yeah, very timely. Lindsay, have you got particular titles in mind for your excursions?
The great thing about holidays is a chance to look away from all the new stuff arriving, piling up in the office every day. And I would like to take a look back at Don DeLillo's The Names, which adds to his lovely modern comedy about Americans abroad trying to work out why everybody hates them so, with brilliantly intense descriptions of the bright blue sun and intense heat of the Greek islands.
Summer's often a time when even the most highbrow among us, which I think I can count you two down for, the most highbrow swoop a little lower. Are either of you tempted by something a little more SF, a little more crime, maybe?
I've never got on with SF, but crime, yes, I would definitely take a Elmore Leonard just for the hell of it, you know.
But you're not tempted by a little murder, Lindsay?
I'm going for rather more getting in touch with my feminine side. With a novelist I'm forever being recommended by people with very otherwise highbrow tastes, which is Jilly Cooper. Her novels, I'm reliably sure, are great fun, so maybe I'll give them a go.
My crime side is slightly bleaker. I've been very struck by the Penguin reissue of the Georges Simenon, and I'm going to take some Georges Simenon, which I've never really read properly, so that'll be a...
Brilliantly short.
Very nice and short. We like short, don't we?
What you doing, baby, later tonight? I got some new steps, I think that you'll like. And down to Max's, there's a real cool band. They're playing dance halls, I'll show you firsthand. Follow me, watch real close. Listen up now, here's how it goes. Dance in the groove now, wait for your cue.
If you're thinking of turning to crime, you may well find yourself collared by Laura Lippman. A reporter on the Baltimore Sun for 12 years, Lippman has been exploring the city's underbelly in a host of best-selling crime novels since 1997, combining a series of mysteries featuring reporter-turned-detective Tess Monaghan with standalones such as Every Secret Thing and What the Dead Know. Her latest, After I'm Gone, weaves the story of a mistress, a mother and her three daughters around a scrap of Baltimore history. When she came to The Guardian, she began by introducing us to the woman at the centre of the book, Bambi, who finds her evening is just about to get a little more interesting.
Hold me, hold me, never let me go under. Tell me what I want to know, and then just hold me, hold me.
There were three men in the door. One was handsome in a very conventional way, with broad shoulders and lots of dark hair, medium height. A boy from the neighborhood, Bert Gelman, a senior, but not a Sigma. One was enormous, a sphere of a man, and jolly-looking, with pink cheeks and a sheen of sweat despite the cold night. The third was on the short side, very dark skin, a biggish nose, and so much energy it seemed to be coming off him in waves. Older. Older than the kids at the dance, older than his companions. Bambi put him at 24, 25. His gaze seemed to say, kid stuff. Although the Sigma dance was very sophisticated, as nice as the country club dances her parents attended. Then the crasher's eyes caught Bambi's, and any flicker of amused condescension faded. He walked straight toward her as if she were a landmark, something famous, something he had been waiting to see all his life. She was the Eiffel Tower, the Empire State Building, the Grand Canyon. Felix Brewer, he said, and this is Bert Gelman and Tubby Schroeder. Which is which, she asked, and the three laughed. They probably would have laughed at anything she had said, though. Actually, I know Bert, she said, putting out her hand. You were a year behind me at Forest Park. This is a private dance, said her date, Barry. Yeah, I'd keep it private, too, a limp affair like this, said the man who had introduced himself as Felix. Felix the cat, Bambi thought, but no, he wasn't cat-like. Nor dog-like. He was, what was smart and shrewd, a little dangerous, but not a predator. A fox? But a fox would eat chickens, given the chance. Limp affair? Do you see he's on the bandstand? Yeah, not bad, but couldn't you get someone like Fats Domino? He's great. We saw him last week on Pennsylvania Avenue. You go to Pennsylvania Avenue, Bambi asked? Of course I do. All the best music is there. You scared of Negroes? I'm not scared of anything, Bambi said. And the Orioles on the bandstand are Negroes, in case you haven't noticed. Bert smiled at Bambi. Lord, this was the problem with dating Barry. Now every high school senior thought her fair game. The age of the fat one was impossible to tell, but he was at least 20 or 21. They seemed an unlikely trio, mismatched in every way. Felix could read her mind. This, he jerked a thumb at Bert, is my lawyer's son, although I guess he'll be my lawyer one day. And this, thumb heading the other way, toward the round one, is my bail bondsman. She laughed her best laugh, a delighted trill. No, seriously, he's a bail bondsman. Not that anyone's had to set bail on me yet, but you never know. So he's not my bail bondsman, I guess, but he is one.
Someone has to be, Tubby said cheerfully.
I'm going to have to ask you to leave, Barry said. Young man, have you served your country?
What?
Have you served? I mean, obviously you haven't been over there, but what's keeping you from signing up? I'm not yet 18, Barry said. I'm going to Penn next year. Well, I went to war when I was 17, but I guess Penn is something, yes it is. Your parents must be very proud. Barry now appeared to be about 6 years old in Bambi's eyes, which, she realized, was Felix's intent.
Look, I must ask you. Oh, as long as you're asking, and as long as you must. But tell me something. Couldn't a serviceman, one who fought to keep this country safe, who skipped college and all it had to offer, would it be too much to let me have one dance with the young lady here in recognition of my patriotism? Look, this isn't a dance hall. You don't just come in here and ask to dance with girls.
Oh, Barry, Bambi said, what's the harm? The Orioles began a new set. Hold me, Felix said, and she thought it was a request. Then he added, they had a hit with this in 1953. They're good for local boys. He led her onto the dance floor, not even bothering to wait for her date's permission. He was not a smooth dancer, but he was a happy one, full of energy. They did not speak at all. He held her gaze, testing her. They were almost at eye level.
She calculated the height of her heels, put him at maybe 5'7". She didn't care. He sang along with the song. Not in her ear. He wasn't that obvious. He just seemed to like the song.
When you make me tell you I love you, I love you. Yes, they keep telling me, be sensible with your new love. Well, this won't be the last you'll find.
How did you start with Felix Brewer?
Felix Brewer was a story inspired by a real-life Baltimore story, and it was one my husband had been begging me, cajoling me, lecturing me to write for several years, and I really couldn't see it. I feel like I have to back up and tell this backstory, which is when I first started dating my husband, and I will say that he's David Simon, creator of The Wire, although when I started dating him, he was not David Simon, creator of The Wire, but an out-of-work TV writer who had no projects in front of him. He had this photograph on his refrigerator of a very beautiful stripper named Pam Gale.
That's a difficult call for a guy who's...
Yeah, and Pam Gale had worked on what we called the Block in Baltimore, which is a row of strip clubs. And she had still been alive and running a strip club that had been given to her by her ex-boyfriend when David was a police reporter. Pam's ex-boyfriend was Julia Salisbury, and Julia Salisbury was in every way this nice, upper-middle-class, community-minded, religious, Jewish father and husband who also happened to be the gambling kingpin of Baltimore and owned a couple of strip clubs, but had never done anything violent, had never participated even indirectly in violent activity. He just made money off of sports book and other gambling, the street number game. And the feds were after him for a while, and in the 70s they finally got him, and they gave him a pretty severe sentence for a not-so-severe crime, mail fraud. I believe he got 15 years, and under that system, might have served 5, and I guess he decided he just couldn't do it. And while he was appealing his sentence and out on house arrest, he walked out the door one day and was never seen again. There are a lot of rumors about him. People believed that he fled to Israel because he had purchased quite a few Israel war bonds and that he was living there under an assumed name. There were these wild rumors that he would sneak back into town for certain things, such as, I think, Pam's eventual funeral. And so David would say, oh, it's such a good story. There's his wife, there's his girlfriend, there's his wife, there's his girlfriend. And that didn't interest me. It was a romantic triangle. I didn't see anything there. And maybe he was saying this all along and I didn't hear it, but one day I finally did hear him say, there's his wife, there's his girlfriend, and he had 3 daughters. And then I saw something, and it was just that moment of, okay, that I can work with. If I have the 2 generations, the 3 different relationships, I want to tell the story about them. I'm not the least bit interested in Julia Salisbury in real life. I don't care what happened to him. David at one point was encouraging me to go find his daughters and talk to them and say, maybe they'll tell you where he is. I was like, I don't care where he is. I'm not writing about Julia Salisbury. I'm now writing about Felix Brewer, but I'm really writing about Bambi and his girlfriend, Julie, and their 3 daughters.
For about half of this book, we're inside these women's head as they go out on dates and get married and bring up their children and just try to get along. Was it your ambition right from the start to chart how women's lives have shifted in America over the last 50 years?
I want to say that because it sounds so smart, but it took me a long time to get there. It took me a really long time to figure out the story was in the backstory. I think that in the initial going, this book initially began, you know, in the early part of the 21st century. It was going to start at a high holiday celebration. It was going to begin with a chapter that now is 3/4 of the way into the book. And I was like, no, that wasn't working. And I had to keep backing up and backing up and backing up. It seemed to me that I was lost inside of it for at least 9 months.
Because, I mean, it's constructed as this series of flashback, jumping forwards and backwards, threaded along the developing investigations of this cold case specialist, Sandy Sanchez, in 2012. But did you know straight away you were going to do it in this kind of jump cut?
I started off with, the story begins here. with the girls are grown up, and one of them shows up at synagogue wearing a too expensive watch and a fur coat, and this creates attention from someone who has reason to believe that maybe her father is back and she's getting his money or something like that. It's like, well, no, that's not it. Finally, it took me a really long time, and it's the sort of thing you look at the book now and you say, how can it be that it took me so long to figure out that Bambi was the heart and soul of the book? But once I figured that out, then I had it. I mean, it's Bambi, and in counterpoint, it's Sandy Sanchez, the detective who takes on the cold case.
Early on in the case, Sandy has a kind of flash of realization that some, you say, might call a hunch, but is more accurately described as an equation as neat as arithmetic or a proof in geometry. Is that how it feels to you when a piece of fiction comes together?
I'm okay with my work being based on hunches and intuition, although I'm also aware that when you're a novelist, you solve problems again and again through having done the work. It's your craft. You do it every day. And so the fixes are there. This was really inspired by a real-life homicide cop named Donald Warden. You know, self-educated. I'm not sure he made it through high school in the United States. Grew up in Baltimore. You know, looks like a big, dumb hick. And you allow yourself to think that of Donald Warden at your peril. Homicide investigation was his genius. And there's a story about him. It actually appears at the end of the book, Homicide, written by my husband long before I knew him, in which he's driving to work one day and he sees a sailor crossing the street with someone unlikely looking. Just like they don't look like they belong together. And he notices that. And sure enough, that sailor is murdered. And he is able to solve the crime from his memory of seeing that. And people said, oh, that's a lucky hunch. But he would say, but you wouldn't have seen what I saw to begin with. My eye is trained to notice things that other people don't see. I'm forever looking at the world and seeing what doesn't fit and filing it away for use later. Donald was the inspiration for Sandy Sanchez in terms of life story and temperament. And I always loved that idea of the retired cop who comes back and solves a homicide because he wants to. It seemed very pure.
You've been writing Tess Monaghan books since 1997, interleaving them between standalones since 2003. There's even space for her to appear in After I'm Gone. Was it clear to you all along that she would turn up, or was she another character who just demanded to be let in?
Once I knew Sandy and knew what I wanted to do with him, I saw that he would somehow end up talking to Tess. You know, we joke in Baltimore that it should be called Smaltimore. It is one of those cities where there's one degree of separation. You run into people all the time. So it seems like the most natural thing in the world for my characters to run into each other. And it made sense that the person that Sandy ran into was Tess's boyfriend, now her partner and the father of their child, who was one of the few people to frequent Sandy's failed restaurant. You know, of course he did. He would have been the one. And that he even, you know, shares some wisdom from his private eye wife, which Sandy secretly thinks is kind of bunk. And the thing was, is that I'd been on a long hiatus from Tess. I got very clever a few years ago and decided I was going to do an update of Rear Window and Daughter of Time, in which Tess would be on bed rest with a difficult pregnancy and solve a crime while on bed rest. And she had a baby. It's like, uh-oh, she had a baby. And I don't know how to write about a private eye with a baby. And so I had to really put her aside. And another thing I tell students is when you have a problem in your manuscript or you have a problem and you don't know what to do with it, run right at it at high speed. You write about a private eye with a baby. You make that the story. She's a mom, and you give her a mom case about sort of the nightmare mom who has killed her own child in what has been judged to be postpartum depression. And you make Tess confront everything about her life that doesn't make it mesh with being a mom. And so, you know, of course, now how do I go back to her? I've told the mom story. I don't know what's left.
There's a whodunit at the center of this book, of course, but you'll seem much more interested in the women of the story than the identity of the killer. I mean, do you ever imagine leaving crime fiction behind? Is there a kind of straight novelist waiting to emerge from beneath your hard-boiled best-selling skin?
You know, I think I am a crime novelist. It's important to know who you are and what you do. And I don't have a problem being a crime novelist because the form has no limits. I have plenty. The genre in and of itself, there's nothing about it that says, okay, you can't write a great novel while playing by the rules of the crime genre, whatever they are. If anyone knows them, please fax them to me as soon as possible.
Girl, they told me to be sensible with your new love. Don't be a fool, thinking this is the last you find. But they never stood in the dark with you, love. When you grab me in your arms and slowly drive me out of my mind.
Laura Lippman's After I'm Gone is published in the UK by Faber. We'd love to hear if you'll be taking Murder to the Beach or something else entirely. Just search for the Guardian Books podcast online and join in the discussion. Or if the book along list has you up in arms, there's still time for you to nominate the one novel the panel have unjustly overlooked for our own rambunctious literary award. Search for Guardian's Not the Booker Prize. The vote to assemble our alternative long list begins on Monday. Meanwhile, in the Guardian Weekly, Jessica Contrera catches up with the athletes who are making J.K. Rowling's Quidditch into a global pastime. Next week, the Books podcast will be at the Guardian Book Club, where Chimamanda Ngozi Adichie discusses her latest novel, Americana. You can listen online, follow us on SoundCloud, or subscribe via iTunes. Until then, from me, Richard Lee, and our producer, Tim Mabey, thanks for listening.
Follow me, watch real close, listen up, now here's how it goes. Now wait for your cue. Move nice and smooth. Now here's what you do.
First step,
lead your baby to the dance floor.
Next step,
grab her by the hand now.
Third step,
moving on over.
Next step,
now pull a little closer.
Support for this Guardian podcast comes from Squarespace. When you need to know what's in the news, you turn to The Guardian. When you want to create something newsworthy, you turn to Squarespace, the all-in-one platform that makes it easy to create your own professional website for your small business, online store, professional portfolio, or blog. Getting started takes only seconds. Just go to squarespace.com, and to support this podcast, use the offer code GUARDIAN to take 10% off.
For more great downloads, go to theguardian.com/audio.